Hey, thanks. I'd like to thank the conference organizers for inviting me. My name is Matt Grayson. I'm going to be talking about work that I did with my thesis advisor, Dan Tsui, down at Princeton University, on tunneling into the edge of the fractional quantum Hall effect. This work was done in Albert Chang's lab at Bell Laboratories, and all the data that I'll be showing is from samples grown by Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West. I'm currently at the University of Maryland in the group of Dennis Drew. Okay, here's the story. I'd like to review, as repetition is the mother of understanding, I'm going to review a couple of things that were covered this morning, and it'll all look familiar to you. The integer effect, the edge of the integer effect is a 1D Fermi liquid. The edge of the fractional quantum Hall effect due to interactions is predicted to be a Luttinger liquid, which gives a value for the characteristic parameter alpha. I'm going to describe the experiment that we use to create a device whereby we can tunnel into the edge of the fractional quantum Hall effect. There's two experiments that we do, conductance as a function of field and IV, tunneling IVs. And then we can measure this alpha, compare it to theory, and see what we've got. And then the results, experiment versus theory, and I do mean versus. There are some very interesting discrepancies between the two. And about 2 minutes after my time is up, I would like to discuss the resonance behavior that we see on the edge. So first off, a generic one-dimensional system. If there are no interactions, we have two counterpropagating modes. For spinless electrons, we have conductance is quantized to the conductance quantum, which is E squared over H. The density of states is simply the reciprocal of the Fermi velocity, which means that it's possible to stick electrons at the Fermi energy. However, when we introduce interactions, half a century ago, Tominaga first discovered this situation in one dimension with interactions. Repulsive interactions will reduce the conductance below the conductance quantum. And perhaps even more interestingly, there is the correlation between electrons causes there to be a zero in the density of states at the Fermi energy and a power law for energies beyond there. And the same characteristic parameter that reduces the conductance is seen in the exponent here, which characterizes the power law in the density of states. Now that's a generic one-dimensional system. We're going to be discussing the particular one-dimensional system that was theorized by Zhao-Gang Wen to exist at the edge of the fractional quantum Hall effect. And why is the edge of a two-dimensional electron system in a magnetic field a one-dimensional system? Well, in the bulk of the sample, we have the angular momentum quantizes us to discrete energy levels in these stationary orbits. But when the orbits intersect the edge of the sample, you have these skipping orbits. And whereas in the bulk of the sample, you only have discrete allowed energies, at the edge there's no gap to excitations, because we can infinitesimally increase the momentum of this traveling particle. So there's no gap on the edge. Because of the fact that this mode is traveling in only one direction, it skips around disorder, and we have what we call a chiral one-dimensional system, since it only flows in one direction. So you can think of this as a chiral one-dimensional system, which is bounded electrostatically on one side by the edge of the sample and bounded by the quantum gap on the interior side. So what that means when we feed it back into this picture is the integer quantum Hall effect is a 1D Fermi liquid. Here I've written it as a chiral system with only one one direction of propagation. Even if we introduce interactions among these constituent particles, we write down a Lagrangian and include interaction terms between the electrons. With a simple change of variables, we can write all the physics is captured in a Lagrangian for a new quasi-particle which has fermionic statistics. It has electron charge, so the quasi-particles can be treated as non-interacting quasi-particles, and therefore we're once again in a non-interacting system, which is a 1D Fermi liquid, and so we have this constant density of states at the Fermi energy. And in the chiral Luttinger liquid system, clearly interactions are important because in the bulk of the sample, it's the Coulomb interactions that define the quantum Hall gap. And these interactions on the edge give us this reduced conductance, where the reduced conductance is defined by the bulk quantum of the fractional quantum Hall effect, this quantum number, which is 1 over m. And so the interesting thing about this quantum Hall system is that we have a way of predicting what this characteristic Luttinger parameter is, whereas before, with the standard one-dimensional system, that might not be known. So thanks to Xiaogang Wen and subsequent work by Kane and Fisher, we're able to predict what this value should be. Okay, this is the proverbial sledgehammer. We're measuring the tunneling IV, so we're going to measure the tunneling density of states integrated over our applied voltage will give us our total current. From now on, alpha, I'm going to refer to alpha as the experimentally measured exponent, and we'll reserve nu and g for the theoretical values. Now, we are certainly not the first group to do this. Originally, this was attempted in a different geometry by Millikan and subsequently repeated by a group here at Santa Barbara, where they tunnel through a point contact between two adjacent Hall systems. And effectively, you're measuring the product of the density of states, one from your source, one from what you're tunneling into, and you measure this power law in the conductance. But unfortunately, due to the smoothness of the confining barrier, you only get about a decade or less of energy scale. In this case, the energy scale is introduced by temperature-dependent measurements. So the advantage of the geometry that Albert Chang used in 1996 and I subsequently followed up with is that we have an alloy barrier which is very sharp. It allows us to do voltage-dependent measurements. We can use a voltage scale. We can bias this junction and measure the tunneling density of states with voltage biases. You can do the same thing with temperature-dependent measurements, and Albert has done that. So that's all for the review. I'm going to go in and look a little bit at the structure of the device itself so that we can get ready for the experiment. So this is cleaved edge overgrowth, which many of you may have seen, pioneered by Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West. And you take the sample. Here, blue is the thing I want you to focus on. The sample has a quantum well previously grown into it. Then it's reinserted into the growth chamber on its end and prescribed. And then we cleave, break it in half, and grow with MBE on the fresh cleaved edge. And in the case of this sample, we grow a tunneling barrier followed by a metallic electrode. So, for example, this growth existed before cleaving. This is the cleaving plane, and here's the growth direction for when we grew the barrier in white followed by N plus gallium arsenide. I've designated the existence of electrons with the color blue. So when we apply a quantizing magnetic field, that puts our two-dimensional system into the Hall effect regime. So that means that we will have this edge channel that I described previously will sort of flow down this edge, along this edge, and then have an entire edge of our edge channel, which will be adjacent to this tunneling barrier. And that's what we're interested in probing. Okay, once again, zooming in on it, this is the junction. There's going to be a chiral edge mode going through here, and then we're going to tunnel into that, tunnel electrons in and out of that, and see what the density of states looks like. All right, here's measurement number one. Tunneling conductance versus magnetic field. In this case, we just send the current through, for example, send the current in through this lead, out through that lead, sweep the magnetic field and see what we got. So at first we see this 1 over B type behavior here with plateaus. This is simply the quantized Hall conductance. So at low magnetic fields, it looks like we're just doing a two-point measurement of a standard Hall system. But at higher magnetic fields, we see this exponentially decreasing decay. I blew it up by orders of magnitude so you could see what's going on in this tail. So how do we come to grips with this behavior? Well, both the barrier and the two-dimensional system have a dependence of their resistance on magnetic field. So we can model, this is a top view of my device. So this is the two-dimensional system, here's the barrier, here's the N plus. We can say that there's basically two resistances in the problem. I have to get from, I send current into my two-dimensional electron system, it encounters the barrier, then it tunnels through. So there's a two-point resistance of the 2-deg in series with the tunneling resistance. Now, at low enough magnetic fields, the resistance of the barrier is basically zero, and I'm just doing a two-point measurement of my Hall effect right there. Then at sufficiently high magnetic fields, we see a crossover here around, I guess that's around 8 Tesla. The barrier resistance dominates, and I'm actually measuring the tunneling conductance at this higher range. Now, that means that with each device, if I make this barrier thicker, this onset is going to occur at a lower magnetic field. But then again, here I'm measuring... sensitivity of my measurement is something on the order of 100 gigaohms resistance is the largest resistance I can measure before I plunge into the noise. So I cannot, at some point, I cannot get any more data out of the device. So there's a certain range for every device of useful filling factors that I'm able to get information out of. So for a given device, the minimum magnetic field I can use is the one that is defined by this crossover. The tunneling resistance has to dominate the two-point resistance of my measurement. The maximum magnetic field in the case of, in Albert's lab, the 15 Tesla magnet, he showed you that he was able to take these devices to a higher magnetic fields and get more information out of them. But for this experiment, that was my limit, and either that was the maximum magnetic field, or perhaps I get below my noise sensitivity. And these magnetic fields correspond to a minimum and maximum filling factor that I can attain with each device respectively. So this is the advantage of having Lauren Pfeiffer on your side. These are the 24 samples grown by Lauren Pfeiffer, as well as these are the two were grown at Princeton. These were all designed by Albert Chang and grown by Lauren Pfeiffer. You can see that we have a variety of barrier widths. We have thin barriers, thick barriers. Most of the carrier densities are around 1.1 times 10 to the 11. The mobilities range anywhere from 500,000 to 3,000,000. And the accessible filling factors, when you plug all that information into there and chug it through, you get this filling factor index. So what we're interested in doing in particular is accessing the 1/3 fraction, but we'd also like to see some integers. So what we're going to do is look at three samples of varying mobilities, low, medium, and high, from 500,000 to 2,000,000 to 3,000,000, all of which can give us a 1/3 fraction. And we're also going to look at another sample that can get us into the integer filling factors. Okay, here's the experiment number 2. Is measuring the log of IV of the tunneling current, log current versus log voltage. So when you see this, you can see right off that there are basically three regimes. You have a linear regime here, a power law, which is steeper than linear, and then it saturates again to a linear behavior at high excitations. It's a fairly difficult experiment. We're down here measuring femtoamps at microvolt excitations. Let's see, so we can empirically, let me just show you what these three different behaviors look like. We saturate to some linear conductance. This is the power law region that we're principally interested in. Now what's going on down here is the voltages that we're exciting the sample with are smaller than KT, smaller than the thermal energy in the system, so we cannot resolve power laws down there. We're washed out by temperature. And in the high regime, what happens is you're applying such incredibly large voltages that your barrier once again becomes transparent and it is the two-point conductance of the whole system that limits the current. So we saturate at 1 over RXY. So we do this over and over and over and over and over, and you end up with something that looks like this. So at low fields is this the purple trace here, and the red trace here is at high fields. You can see that as we increase the magnetic field or decrease filling factor, the power law gets steeper and steeper. The power law exponent is increasing monotonically. Let's see. The useful information we can get out of a single device is sort of broken into these three regions. We can't learn any information below the thermal voltage here. We also can't learn any information when we're saturated above this line, which represents E squared over H, which is roughly the two-point conductance of the two-deg. So we can only get power law information out of this quadrant. And you can see that as the field gets lower and lower, we get fewer and fewer decades of power law, which makes it harder and harder to call it power law. So the error bars increase as we get down to these higher and higher filling factors, which I will show you shortly. Okay, so how are we going to fit this? We're interested in getting the exponent alpha out of that. The easiest thing to do is to just slap a ruler on there and say, okay, wiggle the ruler around, those are our error bars. You could be a little bit more methodical and develop an empirical circuit and say, let's say all of our power law is captured in this nonlinear element. Our saturation resistance is the two-point resistance of the two-deg, and this sort of thermal resistance effectively shorts our power law behavior at low excitations. So you can do this. You've got four fit parameters. That's nice. There's no physical basis for it, but it does the trick. However, there is a theory for such a situation. When I'm in the nu equals one-third tunneling from the n plus metal into nu equals one-third, Chamoun and Fradkin invented a theory describing how you could model such conduction. And their theory describes a fit that works over the full range of our device very well. So the theory predicts that when nu equals one-third, you should have an exponent of 3. Here we have an exponent of 2.8. But if we use this as a fit parameter and just stick it in there, we get an excellent fit over 5 decades in voltage and 8 decades in current. It's really quite impressive, especially this knee up here. If you fit this with this circuit model, the knee up here doesn't fit very well, whereas their theory fits it perfectly. So what we did is, this theory only has 2 fit parameters because the experimental temperature we know and the saturation resistance, which is just the Hall resistance, we know that as well. So this is much easier for us to use to get smaller error bars on our fits. So we're going to abuse this theory and apply it at filling factors that it's not meant for. We're going to apply it at filling factors other than one-third when the theory is only supposed to be good for single edge mode systems like one-third, one-fifth. Now the net result is this. This is the reciprocal filling factor versus exponent. And here you can see Albert's previously published data at these points fits fairly well with what we observed in these samples. The most impressive thing is the smooth linear behavior here, especially characterized by the blue line. It looks as though the exponent is just proportional to 1 over filling factor. You can see that as we approach the integer, Hall effect, the exponent saturates near the value of 1, as you would expect. And so when we take the three points of the simplest theory that was only concerned with the Laughlin states, the 1/3, and 1/5, those look fairly good. We anticipate, or the anticipated value of 3 is slightly lower, but it's nothing to be too sad about. When we're experimentalists, we can always find a reason to fudge something. But the surprise comes when, actually, let me backtrack just a second and show you the error bars in this measurement. If I use the Shimon and Fraken fit, when I'm far from filling factor 1/3, as I get further away, I tend to see two behaviors. There'll be one exponent that will be able to fit the low energy excitations, and a different exponent which will fit the high energy excitations. Those are what I qualify as my error bars, and I assume that if I were to force a line through the entire set of data to give it one exponent, it would fall between those two. And so let me lay these error bars on top of there so you can get a feeling for the accuracy of this measurement. These are for the blue data from sample M. So you can see that you get a larger span here. One thing that's interesting is that the error within a single sample is roughly comparable to the scatter between samples. Okay, so what were we supposed to have expected? We look at the theory by Xiaogang Wen and Kane and Fisher, which is coincident with the theory by Shaitov, Levitov, and Halperin. And even though they are approaching the problem from different physical principles, they still achieve the same characteristic alpha versus RXY, which we don't observe. There are two things remarkable about the fact that we don't observe this. One, they predicted for the exponents for filling factors between 2 and 3, when you have only co-propagating modes, they predicted there should be no change in the exponent. That's the reason why this exponent is 3 over this whole range, whereas only when there are counter-propagating modes do they predict that there should be some renormalization of the exponent. So here you can see 2/5, for example, has co-propagating edge modes, and that is predicted to fall right here, whereas the counter-propagating modes reduce this value like this. That's thing number one that is remarkable about the observations that we made. Thing number two is as follows. Let's look at the original data and put the Hall effect as measured on that same sample. And what you see is for an entire span of magnetic field, you have a plateau in your RXY, which is not reflected in this exponent. That appears, so for example, okay, RXY is equal to 3 over this whole range, whereas the exponent spans values from like 2.7 to say 3.2. So if we plot that on this previous curve, that means that RXY has a value of 3, alpha has a value from 2.7 to 3.2. That's the kind of feature that you get due to the fact that we don't see plateau structure in our exponent. So the two remarkable things are, one, we don't see this independence of the exponent on filling factor over this range. Two, we don't even see plateau structure. This sort of digs against the very grain of the quantum Hall effect to begin with, because the whole point of the quantum Hall effect is you have regions in your energy spectrum where you have localized states and delocalized states. And when your Fermi energy sits in your localized states, you can sweep back and forth and not change the Hall conductance of your system. Whereas therefore you have a quantized Hall plateau. But here, when we're tunneling into the edge of the system, there seems to be no discrimination between whether we are in the localized states or the delocalized states that we know exist in the bulk. For some reason, at the edge, we don't see evidence of this. Okay. So, one point that I would like to make to the to the community and to the theorists to let you think about is, what is the true electronic structure at a sharp edge, given that we don't see this? And the particular point I would like to make is that you have an atomically sharp barrier, which means that the potential that the electron sees as it approaches the barrier increases as you're within one magnetic length of this barrier due to quantum confinement, because that's the shape of the wave function. So if you have a potential that the electron sees which zooms up over the order of the magnetic length, how is it that the Laughlin state can be preserved when the Laughlin state is concerned with energetics between constituent quasiparticles that are root 3 magnetic lengths away? And furthermore, the Coulomb interactions that are responsible for the for creating the gap in the Laughlin state, you know, it's a long-range interaction, so you do require an isotropic system. So the fact that you chop it in half means that perhaps the Laughlin state doesn't survive just due to this breaking of translational invariance that occurs at the barrier. So, and I do want to mention that there are many groups that are grappling with this, that have come up with theories as to why you might expect this exponent to go like 1 over RxY, but I still have not yet heard any proposals as to why there's not even any structure of Hall plateaus. This addresses issue number 1, but not issue number 2. Okay. So in conclusion of that segment of the talk, we see the power law IVs over a whole range of filling factor. The behavior is the same in samples of slightly different n and principally very different mobilities. It increases linearly with 1 over nu and saturates to a lower limit. And the buzzer has not sounded again, so I'm going to jump ahead and show you what I wanted to show you, which is the observation of a tunneling resonance at the edge of the fractional quantum Hall effect. Same view graph, different title. In our tunneling conductance versus magnetic field sweep, there was a little blip here. You know, it could have been anything. Someone turns on a hairdryer next door. You never really know. But it turns out this thing was reproducible. So we go back in there and zoom in on this thing, subtract out a background conductance, and you end up seeing this tunneling conductance around 13.5 tesla in this edge tunneling device. We fit it to the derivative of a Fermi function, which are these little dots. And you can see it's an extremely high Q resonance if you think in terms of magnetic field. You're sitting at 13 tesla, whereas the line width is 180 gauss. And we see it in several of the different samples. I should say two different samples, and only the higher mobility ones. The 2 million mobility sample gives us a small lump of magnitude 2.4 nanosiemens. The 3 million mobility sample gives us a 2 orders of magnitude higher peak. And the second time we cooled it down, we got an interesting family of mother and daughter resonances. And I don't expect to be able to do much more than flash this data before your eyes given this time constraint, but let me just mention that we did measure temperature dependence of this resonance. And basically, the line width increases linearly with temperature. The peak height decreases like 1 over T, all while the background conductance away from the tails goes like T squared. So we've got a background conductance, which is Luttinger liquid-like, and yet we have a resonance which is behaving like a Fermi liquid because it has approximately the shape of the derivative of a Fermi function, but more importantly, its temperature dependence conserves area. And another enticing bit of data. Since we can apply a voltage bias across our junction, we do just that. This is the original resonance which I showed you previously. The red curve is the experimental data. When I apply a bias of 20 microvolts, the resonance splits into a small and high peak. And as you can see, we're able to fit this with a very simple model. All of the black lines are theoretical fits. and the model just presumes, the model presumes nothing more than a small localized resonance sitting in the barrier and different tunneling lifetimes in and out, and that's sufficient to reproduce all this data. So that's the conclusion of that secondary work. Let me put up those.
What was the highest that the conductance on the resonance, the largest?
The largest was 200 nanosiemens, which is a factor of 70 below the E squared over 3H. And let me just conclude, there was an errata and my address did not get published properly. Thank you.
These resonances occurred close to filling fraction of third.
Close to filling fraction of third. And I should mention that there was one sample where we grew the filling factors that you can access and the barrier thickness are intimately related. So we grew a thicker barrier, which allowed us to access the fractions between 1/2 and 1, and we did not observe any resonances between 1/2 and 1. So either the resonance is due to actually the fact that the 1/3 filling factor is special, or it's just a bit of crud that's inside the barrier, and it just didn't happen to be inside that second growth. The typical conductance of the resonance, it changed by two orders of magnitude. The maximum conductance was 20 nanosiemens, which is 1 over 70 times E squared over 3H. So much smaller. We're probably in the sequential tunneling regime because it's much smaller than the maximum conductance for such a resonance.
Why does the resonance speak?
Well, if I didn't realize the resonance would be the big hit of the show, I would have spent more time on it. Why does the resonance split? The reason it splits, it splits for exactly the same reason that Case-Decker's resonance has split. You apply a bias. Let's see. When you're sweeping magnetic field, what you're doing is you're sweeping the resonance energy past the Fermi energy in the two leads. So you've got your resonance state here, and as you increase magnetic field, it sweeps up, and so you see a resonance at a specific magnetic field. When I apply a bias across the junction, this is my Fermi energy on the left, this is my Fermi energy on the right, then you will get a conductance resonance when your resonance sits here, and also at the magnetic field when you pass this lead.
But the resonance is DIDV, right?
Yes, DIDV. It's not a it's right. Right, right, right. Sorry. Leonard.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on the discussion in relation to the field and experiment. This observation that there is no flattening in the full third suggests that, well, as you said, electrons don't know about what's happening in the pulse. Some electron perhaps just within the characteristic time which Borrow what he's doing with and measurement voltage doesn't spread into the bulk. So all the theories discussed, they somehow assume mixing and these universal results, they rely on one or another mechanism mixing of the modes. And there is no mixing because the system is too clean, then there is no real contradiction. Now, you can try to estimate the mean free path, for example, by using a similar system that was used in the Miriam Kobus experiment, who looked at channels and observed quantization in point contacts up to channel length of 20 microns or so. Now, if you say that 20 microns is an estimate from the mean free path, then it's easy to check that for the voltages that you use in deriving the power loop, electrons traveling along the edge don't go that far. Right. So So if it's that simple, if the system is simply too clean to provide anything, then you just need to introduce a sort of order, which presumably would be easy to do, and then we'll go to the regime where comparison to the field would be
right. Right. So I think I can. I can very briefly summarize the statement, which is that if you assume penetration of the electrons deep into the bulk, then you should observe bulk properties. And it seems like we're not observing bulk properties. So perhaps the electrons are staying near the edge. And if they're staying near the edge, why? And Landon was saying that if it's a particularly clean system, as you might expect from Amir Jacobi did edge grown wires where he got path lengths of 20 microns. So the question is, perhaps if the system is that clean that you actually are not mixing into the bulk, then that might be sufficient to explain why this data does not reflect the bulk. Taking into account bulk. Verify experimentally what? Yes, in the Hall resistance. I mean, what we do is we have contacts on the. Oh yeah, I need to repeat the question. Thank you. So the question is, do we know that we have a plateau at 1/3 in this device? And the answer is as follows: we do 4-point measurements on this part of the sample where we do see strong plateau structure. We tune to the same magnetic fields, and then do our measurements there. And that data, the overlay that I showed you, was exactly that. The crossover at high bias is RXY. And the thing that's particularly fascinating is that at high biases, you recover the quantum Hall effect. In other words, a two-point measurement, since RXX is smaller than RXY in these samples, a two-point measurement is approximately RXY. That's roughly what you're measuring. And you actually do see plateaus in the value of the saturation resistance. So that's particularly remarkable. You've gone through this regime where you saw no plateau structure in the exponent. You go to sufficiently high excitation energies and you recover the plateau structure. Yes, we have done some preliminary stuff. I did some stuff. Albert did some stuff, and I think Leonid is working on some things. We have done calculations, and the general feeling is that there is a slightly, where's Albert? Slightly enhanced density near the edge. I did not. No. But a slightly enhanced density near the edge, which would contribute to a general shifting of the whole trace towards lower reciprocal nu, but does not otherwise affect the data because it doesn't change the density by that much that it destroys the Hall effect.
On what length scale?
On the length scale, which is the distance to the dopant. What is the edge state at one-half filling? That's a question that perhaps Bert and Landon would have a lot of more interesting ideas on how to describe. I mean, the notion is that if it's a compressible composite fermion fluid, that's what you should be tunneling into. The thing that's curious about this experiment, it doesn't seem to discriminate between compressible and incompressible or the hierarchy of the branches.
If you have if you're sitting at nu equals a half, then if you say take any value of the momentum parallel to the surface, there are a continuum of states that have that momentum. Now, depending on the exact shape of the edge, there could be, in addition to this continuum, a finite set of discrete edge states. There could be an infinite set of discrete edge states. There could be no discrete edge state. It all depends on details of what the potential looks like. There could be edge states all moving in one direction. There could be discrete edge states moving in both directions if the edge is complicated enough. And if there's no scattering and the edge is complicated enough, clearly you can get any exponent you want out of it. Now, whether this edge is complicated enough so that an explanation of that nature has to be invoked is, of course, very much in question. But in principle, that's the answer to the question. There's a continuum. There are obviously a continuum of states, and there may be some arbitrary number of discrete edge states in addition.
I think we have to go to the next talk.